This is the Mentoring Developers Podcast, episode 55. Welcome.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Mentoring Developers. I'm really excited to have you here, and I want you to meet Leslie Paolo. She comes from a background that combines computer science with geology, but Leslie wasn't happy with her job. She wanted something more, something exciting, and something creative. She wanted to create software and realized that the fastest way to get there was through a code school or a coding bootcamp. Nothing less than the best code school would do. This is her story. You will learn about her triumphs. You will learn about her successes and her failures and her struggles. And then we will listen to how she overcame all of the problems and how she carries on and finds success in her career. And she has a very bright future ahead of her, and I think all of us can be inspired by that. Now that Leslie has graduated boot camp and is out in the tech industry, she's here to stay. In fact, she's even preparing to give back to the community in an amazing way. Listen in to my interview with Leslie and find out. Here it is. Hi, everyone. Today, my guest is Leslie Paolo. Leslie, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Leslie, you have an interesting story. Tell us a little bit about how you came to the U.S. and then you felt a certain way and then what happened?
Sure. I moved to the U.S. from Venezuela, and Venezuelans love the U.S. There's a lot of great propaganda. There's a lot of love between the countries. And I moved here when I was 9, and it was a little kind of a letdown. I mean, there's a line of opportunity, this feels like there's a lot of energy, but culturally, it doesn't really feel that way when you're here. Until about 20 years later, when I moved into software development, and then you have the energy, you have the opportunity, you have the community that really comes together to help everybody out. So it was kind of like the fulfillment of the propaganda in this field.
Right. So when you started your life in the U.S., you were hoping that you will have a nice neighborhood, you will have people coming over, perhaps you will have a nice social setting that you'll find in many other countries, especially probably in Venezuela, and you're probably a little bit disappointed, but then you discovered software development and how people help each other, which is amazing. Think about it. This doesn't happen in many other industries, and it doesn't happen in many other places in the world, but you found yourself in the right place at the right time. So I congratulate you.
Thank you.
And now you are working as a software engineer for a big company, and we're going to talk about all that. But first, I want to learn a little bit about Leslie. How do you describe yourself? Who is Leslie Paolo?
In the last year, there's been some transformation. And when we talk about the opportunities that I've had, especially moving here, it is something that I'm working towards helping create those opportunities for others. I'm very energized right now, and that's who I am.
Okay, so you are energized. I was going to ask you if you drink a lot of coffee, because that goes around too. Is that where you're getting your energy from?
No, I'm getting my energy from the people around me.
All right.
And coffee, but
yeah. Yeah, people drink soda a lot around in the Midwest, at least in, we call it pop.
Yeah, I was gonna make a comment about pop.
it's so many people. I see so many people drinking Coke and Diet Coke that I'm just amazed because they just keep chugging it down. And I don't drink soda anymore because I get heartburn. So Then I stick with coffee, but coffee also has this a little bit of acidity. So coffee and I also drink hot tea, which I think is great. And that's how I get my energy up, because I'm not a morning person. And I go in to work in the morning. It's a little fight. It's a little struggle.
A little drag.
Yeah. It's a bit of a struggle. It doesn't matter how many hours of sleep I've had. That's the funny thing. It doesn't really matter. It just takes me a little bit to get me going. And I think a lot of my listeners can relate to that.
Yeah. Everyone in my office, I think, is a night person. I'm a morning person, sort of. I work better in the morning.
That's great. It's always good to wake up when the sun is out and then experience the day and work out and leave the house a little bit if you can. If you live in sunny San Diego, then, you know, you have a lot of opportunities to just get out of the house. So,
absolutely.
How's San Diego?
It's great. I live like 3 blocks from the beach. There's a lot of outdoor opportunities. It's like quality of life is definitely high.
The rest of us are absolutely jealous right now.
Yeah, I was at the beach a couple weeks ago. So,
well, that's great. My experience in San Diego was not all that great, but I spent a day or two in the downtown area. I needed to hang out at the beaches. So, okay, that's good. Now, you are not somebody that wanted to be a software developer. You are somebody that was probably trying to figure out what to do. And as you were getting older, when you were in high school, were you thinking about becoming a developer?
Oh, absolutely not. I wanted to be an astronaut. I went to college originally for aerospace engineering, but dropped out. Wasn't until later, much later, that any sort of software development came into my sphere.
So why did you think about software development? Something that I have discovered when I've talked to a lot of my guests, that they're just going down their path and they're happy. And then all of a sudden they realize, oh no, they need to be doing software development. What's your story?
Sure. I was doing GIS, which is database-driven mapping. And a lot of the software you work with, there's ways that you can automate things and you can do scripting. And that's something that I did for a few years, mostly for small water districts. And that was all fine and good, but it was limiting. And I thought maybe I could become a GIS developer and help make these applications. It wasn't until I went to a girl development meetup that I realized that, you know, you don't have to have a computer science degree. You can just, you know, develop it. You can just do it. And from that meetup, I ended up finding Hack Reactor Remote, which is one of the boot camps. I went through that, and it really helped firm up my experience, because yes, I had done database stuff and I had done some scripting and I had done some JavaScript maps very much on the front end with jQuery. But Hack Reactor really gave me like more breadth of experience and how to think about software development.
So do you consider your experience as a GIS database person? Do you think that that's where you started programming, or do you not consider that programming?
I make the joke often that scripting and automation are the gateway drugs to programming, because it's sort of related, but no, actually building a whole system is not that's what I consider sort of a software development. It's the system. Doing the scripting and the automation, you know, you can learn the language, but that's kind of like you go to a different country and you learn how to say, you know, hello, where's the bathroom, things like that. It's very limited. You don't have the full grasp of the language until you've built out systems.
And that's why you decided to go to a code camp. Now, you picked Hack Reactor, and some of my listeners might not be familiar with it. I just wonder why you picked that particular code school versus others, because I know there are others in your area.
I picked Hack Reactor because it was very hard to get into. They boasted a very low acceptance rate, and with, you know, boot camps are unregulated. And I had been thinking about going to Dev Boot Camp in Utah, or I don't remember, Dev Mountain, I think. They offered housing, and they offered a lot of things for about $10,000. But when I talked to them, they were like, yeah, sure, come over. And I thought, oh, that's too easy. Like, I want somebody to tell me that, no, you need to be better. I think it was like the imposter syndrome type speaking up to me, like that I needed to pass some sort of bar, some sort of standard. And Hack Director was, touted its low acceptance rate. And there was a lot of stuff on Quora about how hard it was and how people had gotten rejected. So I thought, okay, if I go there and they tell me I'm good enough, then I'll go to the other one. And I went and I interviewed and they told me I was good enough. And then they told me that there was this deferral, so I wouldn't have to pay them right away. I wouldn't have to do it up front. And then I was like, oh, I could go to one of the better ones. Like, I don't have to, like, be a value shopper, I guess, when it comes to boot camps. So I found them mostly because people complained a lot about not getting in. And I thought, that's what I need. I need somebody to tell me, go learn more on your own.
Right. There's somebody to push you. And if they have a low acceptance rate, then probably the implication is that their quality is higher. Right?
Yeah, I think the implication is that, one, they're not just taking anybody for the money. They're not just growing to grow. They're not going to just take you because you can pay them. And also, it gives you an idea of who else is going to be in your cohort. Because you know everybody else had to pass that bar. So everybody has some sort of level. You're not going to... While in the group, there's a lot of differences in level. You don't end up working with somebody who's a complete beginner, who's like, you know, 3, 4, 6 months behind you. You have people who have passed the bar.
Right. But based on our conversation, I don't know if you considered yourself a beginner. How did you know that you would pass?
I didn't. One of the first things I learned was from when they sent me this stuff for the interview prep. I learned like concepts about JavaScript language, and I didn't think I would pass the bar. I thought, like, I felt strong like in the database things, but in the whole programming paradigm, yeah, I felt I wouldn't say like new beginner. Like, I knew what variables were. Like, I had some familiarity with that and the terminal and from the scripting also.
So tell me, how much does that cost? You don't have to give me exact number if you don't want to, but I want to understand how these top ranked dev schools cost. So I think people would love to know that.
For the on-site program in San Francisco, they just raised the price, and I think they're like at 20,000 or just about there. I did the remote campus, so I did it from home, and it was 17,780. And yeah, sticker shock.
That is huge. And also, it's remote. What does that even mean? How can you have a cohort that's remote?
Well, there's a lot of great technologies. There's video conferencing. You work with a partner with Google Hangouts the whole time. You have access to teachers who, just like how we're doing this interview, you can just speak to them, and you have one-on-one appointments, and you're working just as hard. It's just the person isn't right next to you. You just have your headphones on all day, so you get a good pair.
Okay. Yeah, that's why when I started the interview, I noticed that you had a good headset. Well, now I know why.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. It's a considerable amount of money. Obviously, a lot of people would not be able to pay that. But you said that you were able to pay later, like after you got a job. Is that the kind of deal?
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
And now they have scholarships, so.
Okay, that sounds promising. So if you're somebody that is looking into going into Hack Reactor, if you are listening to this podcast right now, you know that even if you can't afford it, you might want to talk to them and they may be able to work something out. So that's good to know. But you didn't study computer programming in a formal environment. You did something else. You did go to college for an associate's degree. What was it about?
The associate degrees was in computer science.
It was in computer science. Okay.
Yeah. Though my bachelor's is in geology. But that's how I ended up working in GIS. It was one of the requirements to do a GIS class, and I got an internship. So that's how that started, you know, back in 2007. It wasn't that I was looking to be a programmer. I think I was looking to be like an IT person. I thought that that seemed more reasonable.
So you went through 2 years of computer science, and that's pretty good. But that happened before you went to Hack Reactor, right?
Yeah. At the junior college, we did things in Java, and I did for things in C. And it wasn't very interesting, and it wasn't very productive, and it was not interesting.
It was not interesting because there were no projects to do?
Oh, there were projects, but a lot of them ended up being command lines, so there wasn't like a thing. Like we never made a product. We would solve, you know, algorithmic challenges or math problems, or I never made a thing that I could then like show my mom or something. Like there was nothing. There was no end result, so it was unsatisfying in that way.
Right. I think this is a problem with computer science education in general, because the goal of college education in computer science is not to teach you how to build a product or how to do a real world application. The goal is to give you the tools so then you can use it to do something interesting with that. Or maybe you don't. Maybe you just work on other types of activities and other types of tasks that are not products. A lot of computer science people graduated with computer science don't do actual products. They just solve problems in a very targeted set of circumstances. And they might be working on algorithms. They might be working on the concepts and the theory behind, for instance, natural language processing. You know, they might be doing a lot of different things. So it's not necessary that you build products, but if that's what you want to do, if you want to build a website or an app, they're not going to teach you to do that. They're not even trying to.
No, they're not. And that's something that I didn't think about at the time. At the time, I was just, I guess I didn't have the perspective to realize that it was a general training and that I could then go do things on my own, that they were trying to teach me how to learn more than teach me how to build a thing.
Right. And you did go through the 2 years. Now, looking back, do you think that was a waste of time?
Well, I ended up getting a job in GIS for it and had a career for 7-8 years doing GIS. So, no. But mostly for the networking.
Was that helpful, though, the GIS track or GIS career that you had? I mean, now looking back, do you say, well, you know what? I probably should have gone to Hack Reactor earlier.
Oh, absolutely. Hack Reactor was a fantastic opportunity. And if I could have been doing the work at Walmart Labs that I do now, like a few years ago, definitely.
And the now you have,
that was far more interesting, yeah.
Right. And now you have this amazing job at Walmart Labs. First of all, tell us about Walmart Labs. What is it?
Walmart Labs makes Walmart.com, Sam's, and I think they also, I don't want to say too much. I don't know if we do Brazil. We work with some people. But there's Walmart Technology that is based out of Bentonville, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And there I do the work for the stores. We do the website, and specifically I work in business tools, which helps the people who make the website. So
that sounds pretty cool. But what exactly is your job there?
I'm a software engineer, and like I said, we make half of our projects are business tools. And so when you make when you actually see the website, it's made up of modules that people can customize. And so we make the tools that help people to do that design. And the other tool we do is a backend tool, which handles a lot of traffic. And that's the project I'm working on now. And it's in Node, and it had a lot of high traffic, and it's very interesting. and nothing at all like front-end development.
Okay. Now, you start your job. This is your first job, right?
First job in software engineering.
First job in software engineering. And all you have until now is an associate's degree, which you don't feel like that gave you the tools that you needed, and Hack Reactor, which was a few months of Hack Reactor training. But this is now your first full-time software engineering job. They're paying you. I'm assuming they're paying you considerably well, right?
Yeah.
Probably happy with that. They're paying you a good amount of money to do some work that is very important for them. And it's not just a class project anymore. Now, when you started your job, how did that first week, the first month go? Were you overwhelmed? Were you just breezing through things? Did they give you a little bit of helping hand and get you settled in? Or were you just thrown in right into a project?
I was thrown right into a project. The first project I did was performance monitoring. And of course I had help. Of course my coworkers were fantastic and everyone was open to helping. But it was pretty much, we have hired you to do this job, go do the job. And I did the job. I was able to complete it, within a reasonable amount of time and was able to deliver the features to our internal customers. It was at Walmart, they give you the responsibility. I don't know what happens if you fail. I haven't failed yet, so I haven't seen anybody fail. I think that they work very hard in supporting you so that that isn't an option. Like when you're having trouble, it's like, go ask for help.
Right.
So
that's a good motto. That's a good way to do your work. If you are stuck in, you feel like you're not making progress, there are a couple of things you can do. And if you're by yourself, then you won't have the opportunity to ask somebody. I would say, go take a walk, just unplug, go somewhere else, do something else, and come back to it a few minutes later. And a lot of times it just gives you the clarity that you needed, and the answer is right in front of you. Another thing you can do is you could pretend you're talking to somebody and explaining the problem that you're having. And when you do that, it happens to me a lot where I am doing something and I just can't believe that something is not working. It should be. And I call somebody over to look at it. Say, hey, you want to look at it? I don't know why it's not working. So, and then I try to explain what I'm doing because they don't know what I'm doing. As I explain it, in the middle of my explanation, before they had a chance to say anything, I know the problem. I know where the problem is. And it's all about just thinking through things.
And that's happened to me. I asked a coworker that, and as I was explaining the problem, I figured it out. And I was like, can we pretend I didn't ask this question? I was a little bit embarrassed. I was like, because it's simple. But yeah, talking it out is what, trying to explain it to somebody else and synthesize it into small chunks is what helps figure things out.
And if that doesn't work, then obviously you can ask somebody who has more experience and time. The problem that I've encountered as I was starting my career was that a lot of times when you want to ask somebody that obviously knows the answer or maybe they're more experienced, they're usually very busy.
Yeah.
And so not everybody likes to answer questions. So you got to find a sympathetic person that wants to take the time to help you, because they're probably not going to get evaluated on that. They still have to do their work and they have to help you. So be appreciative of that. But in general, I like companies to have this policy where senior professionals and people who have been in the company for a while, they're encouraged to go and seek out the new people. Even there, you could be a new developer, maybe you're a senior developer, but you're new to the company, and just seek them out and offer help and just hang out with them. I think that will make the transition for new employees really good.
Yeah.
So you have some disadvantages. I shouldn't say disadvantages. You are different from And I'm just going out on a limb and saying that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. But generally speaking, in software development shops, you have a certain demographic. A certain type of person works there, right? If you're a woman, that becomes a problem because you don't really always fit the mold. And you're a little bit different. And it's same thing happens with minorities. Same thing happens with people who are older. Maybe you're too young or too old. But whatever is the general flow and general demographic in your company, if you're a little bit off of that, then I have noticed that it can create problems assimilating, and it can create problems finding your place and feeling valuable and feeling appreciated and really a part of the team. What is your experience there?
My experience has been positive. Yes, I am. I think there's five women out of between 50 and 60 people. So we are, maybe there's six. I'm going to say there's six of us. I didn't count myself. So I don't think that there's been a problem work-wise specifically. But I was recently in a car accident. It was minor. I'm mostly just in concussion. But everybody, I had people reaching out to help. I mean, these are people that, you know, I don't have the demographic similarities with. So my experience has been that people are kind and I have assimilated, and that is my experience at work. My experience at work has been fantastic. Out in the community, out at meetups, I will be one out of 70. I'll be the single woman out of 70, and it's much more difficult to try to strike up a conversation. At work, we have the common work, and then that leads to other friendly banter. But out in the community, it's much more difficult to try to, you know, go to this table. You know, you have this six guys standing around, you know, talking about the latest video game, and it's like, shoot, I don't play first person shooters. Moving on. And at work it hasn't been an issue, and I think it is because we do have that common thread, even though demographically it's different. But out in the community, absolutely. The difference in being the odd person out. Because when I go to the meetup and I'm the only woman, you know everybody noticed you. They're not talking to you. But you know everybody saw you. There's no way to be invisible. There's no way to be one of the crowd.
Right.
And then you go back next month and you're still, there's one other person. There's one other woman there or something. But you're still like noticed, and that can be uncomfortable.
Right. I think that this is how it's been historically. I think we can, as a member of the general software development population, I can say that we can do better than that. Personally, I feel that there are things that we can do to encourage and support women and minorities, especially women, and help them in not only attending events, but organizing them, and also, you know, being in positions of power, in positions where they can make decisions, and they can change the culture a little bit if it needs changing. If it's great, then that's fine. But a lot of times our culture is kind of one-sided, and it doesn't take into account other people that are different. Usually that means women. So that's kind of what I feel. And thinking about that, I've heard that you are thinking about or planning to start a group of your own.
Women Who Code is an international organization for women who code. And its main mission is to help women advance and thrive in technology careers. And San Diego does not have a chapter. So I'm going to be launching the chapter in February or March. We don't have a date yet. But interestingly, at Walmart Labs, our office also has its own meetup that has its own mission to help people in. Specifically help women also do the transition into tech. So I'm involved in two groups right now. So when I said I was energized, I am really energized.
That's great.
There's a lot going on right now.
That's great to hear, because we need these groups. We need people like you to start organizing other people like you and people in general. I think that it's good for people in one community to meet with others, right? So Women Who Code, I think, is a fantastic organization. I've had people from Women Who Code on this podcast, and they've been great. They support us, and we support them at Mentoring Developers. But I think that's also a good idea for people from different demographics and also different technologies to meet each other. So the Ruby people should really know some .NET people, I think, and the .NET people should know Java people, and the front-end people should know back-end people. I think it's a good idea. We don't do that. And I go to a lot of events and a lot of conferences, and I find that sometimes it's like an echo chamber where people just like what they like and they hate everything else. It happens a lot, unfortunately. And it's just, I don't think that's very healthy. But, okay, moving on. I am interested in creating a nurturing and enabling environment for new developers to grow and prosper in software development shops. That's my personal interest. Do you think, you have limited experience, in your experience with your own job, and I'm sure you have other friends, other women, and other developers in general that have had jobs and they're working in the software development industry. Do you think we're creating such an environment at these companies? Do you think it's happening, or do you think there's more work to be done?
I think it depends. It's very uneven. Where I work, it's fantastic. It's supportive. They're supportive of women. They're supportive of LGBT. It's a very progressive company in that way. Some friends who work at small startups, at those dev shops, where it kind of like this work all the time lifestyle. There's no balance to it. You know, they have experienced sexism, and I don't know if it's the size, because, you know, a small startup doesn't have a human resources department. They don't have training. And I don't know if that's the difference between that and working for a large corporation, that there is like this top down decision that was made that we are going to be inclusive. For a lot of smaller environments, there isn't that. So if the person, your CEO, your founder doesn't, you know, is probably a man who doesn't really think about this. They might not think through the implications of, like, let's, you know, do an offsite over the weekend and we're all going to work. And, you know, we're going to not necessarily cater to people who have lives outside of that, which tend to be women, because in our society, in our culture, women tend to be the more caretaker roles. So while it might be easy for a dad to say, I'm going to take the weekend off and go, you know, do this thing, it might be much harder for a mother to do that.
That's right. And I think this is something important that we should all consider, especially men in positions of power. So if you're a male software developer or a manager and listening to this podcast right now, listen to what Leslie said just now. It's important that we recognize that we have to be inclusive by design, and we have to do it not just through accident, but by being deliberate about that, right? And we can do it. It's been done. And I know that everybody out there, they mean well. People who have done things that perhaps has made other people uncomfortable, or they've excluded other people, they're not trying to exclude people. They are good people. They're just making bad decisions. And the best way to avoid making bad decisions is to think about what you're doing and ask around. Ask people like Leslie. Ask people who are in different organizations, get feedback on what you're doing. And this is what we talk about in this podcast quite a lot, but nobody else is doing it. So somebody has to do it.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the limitations of the golden rule. People are like, treat others as you want to treat yourself, as you want to be treated. But one of the limitations is that you actually need to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. That you need to see it from their point of view. That just because you aren't offended doesn't mean that somebody else wouldn't be. And a lot of things that I think men don't think about is that it isn't the one-off comment. The one comment is not the problem. It's that as women, we get this one comment from a lot of men. So it's like, if you make something inappropriate, it's kind of like, wasn't that funny? But when you hear it for the 100th time, it's unwelcoming. It's like, this is now an issue. It's not that anything is egregious. It's just the volume.
I think that I will disagree with you a little bit here. I'm going to say that even if you pass a single comment that is sexist, that is offensive, that's a problem. I know that we're so used to just violating each other's feelings, right? We do that all the time. And as a community, as a country, as a community of software developers, we don't like to be politically correct. We don't like to say things because it might offend somebody. We don't want to stop ourselves because it may offend somebody, because we don't want to censor ourselves. We like our freedom. I get all that. I like that. I like freedom. I like the ability to speak your mind and be yourself and not have to restrain yourself. I like that in principle. But when you're working in a professional environment, then you have to look at the other person, how that is affecting that person, and you have to restrain yourself. This is just something we just have to get used to. And if you're somebody that likes to hang out with his buddies and likes to pass sexist jokes, then you are preventing women to come in. First of all, they will be a little threatened, or they will be uncomfortable at least. And even if they laugh at it, and even if they ignore it, they're not going to be happy. And even if there is a woman that loves it, it stops the next person to come in. There is no reason for us to behave that way. And I feel that just because women a lot of times tolerate that, or they laugh it off, I think that kind of encourages a repeat behavior. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. But this is something that I think men need to police among themselves, in the sense that as a woman, it's a huge burden to say that we always have to be the ones who's pushing back. Mostly, because I said it, because it's the volume. Like, it's not about wanting to avoid a single confrontation. It becomes about wanting to avoid a confrontation every time you go out. And even if you do end up laughing at it or kind of ignoring it, what it does, it cuts off that person from being a connection. Like, there's less synergy because you know that this person doesn't really respect you, so you're not really going to work with them. But turns out that they're also a brilliant person who have, you know, great business contacts that would have been fantastic to network with, except that you sort of self-inhibit and close yourself off because this is somebody who, you know, doesn't show you respect. And I think that that's kind of the persuasiveness of it. It's not that people are specifically saying you're a woman, you're not. I mean, people do that on the internet. Like, on the internet, it's horrible. Let's not go there. But like in person, people usually aren't outwardly rude in a professional setting. But when they do make the jokes, it does make it difficult to think of that person as a resource, to think of that person. When we talked about mentoring, like somebody who made the kind of joke, they're not going to be your mentor. They might think of themselves as an open person, but you have just now eliminated them from your list of potential contacts.
And that is really unfortunate. And it's easily avoided. I know there are some people who are just never going to be fit to be a mentor, or they're just not going to change. But that's, I think, a small minority. Vast majority of people who behave in a way that's inappropriate, I believe they will do better if they just knew how to do it. So we should just spread the word that we need to really think about how we act around other people, especially people who are a little bit different. And it's okay if you have to control yourself a little bit. And I don't think it should be on the women to complain, right? The problem is, here's a problem, Leslie. I'm a man, and if I'm in a situation where there are people being inappropriate towards women or other people of, let's say, minorities, but that generally it happens with women, then it doesn't affect me personally. So if I don't speak up, even if I don't like it, I say it doesn't bother me. And I want to make the connection. Like you said, I want to know that person. That person is important. That's a brilliant person, but it is also a jerk. So what do I do about that? And when I don't speak up, when that person who's being inappropriate, that person never hears that he's doing something inappropriate, he probably thinks he's cool and he's going to keep doing it. And that puts you and all the other women at a disadvantage. And it's really unfair. I think this is a point that I would like to make. This is not about you being nice. You have to be fair. And to be fair, you have to give space to people who have been marginalized. And if we are honest with ourselves, women have been marginalized in the work environment in general, but in software development in particular, they've been, you know, sidelined, and women don't come to our industry there. You don't find women trying to become software developers because it's hard. It's hard to be in an environment that's so heavily male oriented. I mean, we hear about what happens with gamers, right? The whole Gamergate thing, where men, I've seen their tweets. They're vicious. And they give women death threats and all that. Obviously, that is insane. A normal person wouldn't do that.
Actually, I think you'd be surprised. I had one experience where I answered some on Twitter. I answered somebody who was being kind of sexist, and then I got targeted, and I got, you know, the horrible, you know, very aggressive tweets and things. And then I ended up meeting one of them at a conference. And we were like, oh, let's exchange Twitter handles, blah, blah, blah. And I saw that, and it's like, I saw the Twitter handle, and it's like, this is this perfectly nice guy who, you know, was friendly and everything. And he sent me something horrible because of the anonymity of the internet.
Right.
And so, like, when you say they're not, I don't know if he's a sociopath or, like, whatever, but in person, he was, you know, somebody that I was thinking, like, this is a great contact. But I knew that Twitter handle. Like, I remembered the name.
this is so sad, in my opinion. It's, I should probably get offended, or I should get mad when, because I love women to have the freedom and the space that they need. I have been talking about women's rights and, you know, just some feminism, right? I consider myself a feminist. I've been talking about this all my life, and this type of behavior, when I hear women getting harassed, it gets me mad. But more than being mad about it, it almost gets me sad, because it's, you know, how pathetic you have to be to troll on somebody who is weak, who is vulnerable. How pathetic is that?
Well, I think I don't think that I am weak and vulnerable. I don't. That's not how I see myself. I see it as a basic lack of respect. I don't think that they see me. I don't see they see me as weak. I think they just see me as somebody who isn't worth as much respect as another man would. Because when men disagree with each other, they disagree with their ideas. If a man disagrees, this is mostly online. But when men disagree with you, they, you know, they get personal. They don't. So I don't think it is because I am weak. I think it is because of a lack of respect.
That's a good point. No, I didn't mean any disrespect by, I didn't call you weak and vulnerable.
I just wanted to make that clear.
No, that's very good. You should stand up for yourself. But in general, women are vulnerable because I know about women that I follow on Twitter, and they get death threats and they are scared. They're really scared because it can happen. If I get a death threat, I will be scared, but probably not as much as if my wife got a death threat, right?
Yeah, and you see it in the news sometimes where a woman, you know, was at a club and she told a man, you know, don't touch me, and then she ends up murdered. So, absolutely. As a woman, in real life, it is very scary. When you talk about people who dox other people and they, you know, give out your address, it's not so much that the person who gave out the address is going to be dangerous, is that there are very unbalanced people out there who will now take that address and do something with it.
Right. So I think that we have to be extra careful with women. I think that I don't think I'm being sexist when I say that. I think that it's important to, when you see somebody and you think that they have a weakness, right, and you're exploiting that, they're giving you these insults because I think they think that it's going to push some buttons and they're going to scare you or something like that. Anyway, we should just stop doing that, and we should really. You know, companies that build these social media platforms, they should provide ways of just eliminating these type of tweets and messages, and just policing that.
Yeah, and when we talk about needing women in tech, I think I read about this company that you can send people money, and you can block people, but if somebody sends you a dollar, they can send you a message. And so there was a woman who was being harassed by an ex-boyfriend, and he just kept sending her $1 so he could keep sending her threatening messages because she had blocked him on other ways, but she couldn't block him from sending her money. And I think if there had been women in the product design, if there had been one woman who would have said there, no, if you block somebody, you really want to block them. Like, you need to make that block 100%. Like, that's a serious... You know, you shouldn't. There shouldn't be a loophole to it. And I think that's one of, when we talk about diversity and needing to have diversity of thought, that's one of the use cases when we talk about women is safety, and that the men who design that tool probably, you know, don't consider, you know, the crazy X to be dangerous, but as a woman, the crazy X, you know, could cause real problems.
Right. And so, as you said, we can probably guess that they didn't have many women in their team when they were developing it. And if you go into any major software development company, if you go into their office, you're not going to find many women. That's just a fact, especially in software development. You're not going to find many. And then you end up with making software that is basically defective. And we've talked about this particular thing in our podcast several times. Because so many of my guests have told me exactly the same things with different pieces of software that you use, and they're completely inappropriately built because they didn't think about women.
Right? Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the struggles that some people go through. And other than facing discrimination, any general thing you want to talk about that... New developers, when they start out, this is what they struggle with. So we can, if you're a new developer listening to this, you can pay attention to that.
DevOps.
Explain.
When we're talking about the hardest part, the part that coming from GIS and what HackRector didn't really prepare me for, which of course, you know, they're limited in what they can do, was. Thinking about an application through deployment, through testing. The DevOps tools tend not to be command line, so you know they all have their different interfaces. And that's not that was one of the biggest pain points for me when I started my job. It wasn't so much the coding. It wasn't understanding some deep computer science issue that I didn't have experience with. Like, I really wish I would have spent more time on Travis CI, you know. That's what I wish I would have prepared better for, was trying to understand the pipeline of how you take a product from how you would take a feature from birth to deployment. The DevOps side of things was a part that I never thought about as a beginner, and that I never thought about when I was building things. And it turns out to be, you know, that is how you get things built, is you have to go through this pipeline.
For somebody who is listening to this and they're thinking, what is this Travis CI? So CI is continuous what?
CI is continuous integration.
All right. What does that mean?
The idea is that the old way of developing software was this waterfall model where you would work for a long time and do one big release after a few months. The idea behind continuous integration is that you always have a stable product. And so when you do this push to master, when you put your code into your master repository, CI takes it through linting, so everything looks right. It runs all the tests. Maybe it does performance tests. Maybe it does regression tests to make sure that you haven't lost things through this edition. And then it actually publishes and deploys your new code. And Travis is just an open tool, which is fairly easy to use and works. And you don't have to like set it up. It's a web tool. Whereas some of the other ones you would have to like download and run locally, which, you know, there's no need to have the extra layer of complication. Just sort of going through the process of deployment would have been what I would like. Once I got hired, like that's what I wish I would have done, was sat down and thought about how you actually deploy things.
Yeah, it's funny how many different tools in unrelated, almost seemingly unrelated technologies that you really have to know if you want to be a professional software developer, right? Not every company will use Travis CI. Not every company will have continuous integration.
No.
But it's a good practice to have. And it's good to learn. And every company will have a deployment strategy. They'll have tools, they have build tools and scripts, and they will have obviously the command line tools and the text editors. Yeah. All these things are not necessarily, technically speaking, they're not really programming, but you need them in order to be successful in your profession. But guess what? Colleges don't teach you that.
No, and I don't think boot camps do either. And Walmart doesn't, or my side of Walmart doesn't use Travis CI. I just mentioned it because it is one of the easier ones, and it integrates well with GitHub. And so that's what a lot of people will be using. They'll be on GitHub, and Travis is a way to also think about testing, because when you're new, testing seems very redundant, because when you write the test, you're essentially duplicating the functionality. But it turns out to be very important, and like you said, it's not the flashy part of it. You don't get to show off your new CI pipeline. Like that's not, you don't put that on your resume as a project you did. but it's important.
I think that if you have done anything valuable that you value, right, and you think that you can talk about, you should definitely put it on your resume, even if it seems unrelated. You know why I say that? Is because if you go to a job interview, a lot of times, almost all the time, when they ask you questions, the people that are asking you questions, they're too busy. They haven't done their homework, and they're just going off the resume. And they're just looking at things. They're trying to find questions to ask you because they're not prepared. So
yeah.
If you put something on your resume that may or may not be related to the job that you're seeking, but there's something that you love to talk about and you're passionate about and you have lots to talk about and there's some things that you can really brag about, right? You've accomplished some great stuff. I would say put it on your resume, and then guess what? They're going to ask you because they're just looking, and something will stare them in the face because they will be like, "What is this thing?" Right? And they will ask you that question, and they will hand you the opportunity to answer it in a nice way and just wow them. So that's my tip.
That is true.
It's something that I have noticed over and over. And I think, so if you're listening to the show right now and you're working on your resume, try to use that tip and let me know how it turns out. My email address is us@mentoringdevelopers.com, but you already knew that, right? So if you could start over, Leslie, what would you do differently as a new developer?
Turn back time, but I would have started sooner. I would have put more of my projects out there sooner. I would have asked for more feedback. That has been, being able to do code reviews has been so useful. I would have looked for the mentor, before I got a job. In the GIS community, that's not really a thing. But I would have reached out to somebody sooner to not ask them, hey, can I have a job type questions, but more like, this is a thing I did. I feel I could do it better. Do you have any suggestions on how I could do like this very small piece better? Because obviously people who can help you are probably very busy. But you can probably find, I would have put in more effort to find somebody who could be a technical mentor.
How would you find a mentor?
Well, I think the meetups are the best way. That's one of the reasons why I'm involved in the two meetups, is because I want to foster that community of helpfulness. Online, I think it's much harder. If somebody's in a rural area, I would say try to engage somebody on Quora or Twitter or something on a personal level and try to start those conversations. Stack Overflow is too aggressive, I think, and it's not really helpful for like code review. But if there's absolutely any meetups, even if it's not in the language that you're trying to learn, if you go to a Ruby meetup, I bet there's people who know JavaScript, right? If you go to a .NET meetup, there are people there who know C#.
Mm-hmm.
So even if your community doesn't have something specifically for what you're trying to learn at the moment, there are people there who will have wider experiences. And that's the best way, is to try to meet people in person.
All right. Do you have any tips on keeping skills up to date?
I would say blogging, but I have done a horrible job of blogging. But it is a great way of doing it, because you learn something. And what we talked about earlier about trying to explain it to somebody, you see the solution. Trying to explain something in writing specifically is a great way of cementing that. The other thing I would say is find organizations to volunteer for. One of the things I did was this map for the Red Cross, and I got to learn some new things. And so one way is to just find somebody who needs something and solve their problem. It's a lot better than some random little side project that, if it gets hard, you put it off to the side. Once you have told this organization you're going to help them, you're probably going to follow through.
And I think it's important that people promote themselves. That's kind of what I think. But I want to ask you about this, because something interesting happened when we were setting up this interview. My producer for this show, she was able to get a lot of information about you just by searching you on Google. And I want to know if that was intentional, if you're setting it up like that, because that's a good thing. If people can find you by using Google and they can find good things about you, that's confirmation that you're legit. So what do you think about that?
It was absolutely intentional. I knew that doing the career pivot, I would need to have some way for employers that when they found me, that they would find good work that I had done, that they would find, like you said, that confirmation that I'm a real person who has done real things. And I mean, it brought me to this podcast, and it helped me with A Woman Who Code, and that. Because it gave me legitimacy. When I said I want to start this chapter, the people at Women Who Code also Googled me, and they also found out that I'm a real person who's really in the industry and has something of value. And I benefit from having a unique last name, so.
I think that's...
I'm findable.
Absolutely. Having a unique name is a feature, and that's, I think, why we have somebody called Kim.com in the world. Right? There are people who change their names to be different. And I wouldn't recommend doing that.
No.
I think that your family may have something to say about that. But yeah, a lot of people have pseudonyms that they use.
Yeah, and I would suggest to use the same one across different platforms so that you are findable. So that once somebody finds you in one place, to use the same handle other places, even if it's not your real name, but just the same handle.
Yeah.
To be able to build that brand so that people know across, so once they find something, one thing interesting about you, they can find other interesting things about you as well.
That's right. And sometimes you may have a name that's maybe a little common. I have a friend whose name is Kevin Mack, and he's a brilliant front-end developer and designer. And his social media and all of his handles and Twitter and everywhere, he's called Nice Transition. I never asked him, what the heck does that mean? Like, where did you come up with that? But I know that he is Nice Transition. So every time he goes to a conference talk, or as a meetup, whatever, he tells everybody, I'm Nice Transition. So, you know, that's his name now. So it almost doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's unique. And as you said, you are findable. I don't even know if it's a real word, but people can find you on Google by looking you up, and they find good things. And make sure that you feed Google what you want people to see, right?
Yeah. I don't know much about SEO, but I know that like if you were to get a site on Medium, that'll get higher ratings than your personal site. So if you're trying to push down some negative things, try to do that. Try to go to the big platforms that will rate higher on Google.
Right, and if you have a name that matches a serial killer's name, or somebody else
handle
that has been in the news for the wrong reasons, you might want to change your name. I'm saying that because this is something that happened to one of the people I met. And that person shares a name with a person who has just been convicted of murder or something. It was in the news for the wrong reasons. So, yeah, that's unfortunate. And you might really want to consider changing your name because... name is a very important part of your brand. All right, Leslie, it's been a very entertaining, very long interview, and I'm sorry if I kept you long, but I enjoyed
it. It was fun.
But I enjoyed every bit of it. I was going to ask you a whole bunch of other questions, but I think I'm going to stop here.
We're going to cut it off. All right.
Yeah, we're going to ask you one last question. What's your best advice for people that are just listening to this podcast and they're thinking, man, Leslie is amazing. I want to be just like her. I want to do whatever she did. I want to get a great job just like she did. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do because I have never done anything like it. What's your advice for that person?
I would go back to the advice of building something for somebody else, as small as it can be. Validate that getting that outside validation that your work is valuable is going to be what carries you through. As for getting a great opportunity, apply to all the places. You never know where it's going to be. I didn't apply to Walmart Labs and waited for this to happen. When I was looking for a job, I applied to all of the places. And then once you get that feedback and you have choices, then you can start looking for fit. But when you are ready to apply, just everywhere. See what opportunities come your way.
That's a good point. Don't deprive yourself of opportunities that you didn't hear about. Let everybody know. I think this is one of the important things. Everybody in your circle of friends, or your network, your professional network, your personal network, they should all know that you're looking for a job. This is your skill set. You don't have to pass around your resume. Sometimes it doesn't work, and I've heard, you know, I've had people give me resumes, and I don't really know what I'd do with that. But at least people should know. So if anybody knows about an opportunity, then that they can think about you, and even if they won't be able to do that, at least they can give you some encouragement. And I think it's good to have a network of supporters.
Absolutely.
Excellent advice, Leslie. So if anybody is intrigued by your story, wants to get in touch with you, how can they get in touch with you?
Leslie Bohuelo. That's my handle on Twitter.
All right.
That's my handle on GitHub.
Good luck.
That's my handle on LinkedIn. Reach out.
Good luck spelling that. So it took me a while to learn how to say your last name correctly. I think it's important that we take the time to call people or use names the way they expect to be, you know, used. And it's a total cop-out to say, I probably butchered your name. I think that if I take some time, I probably will not butcher your name. At least that shows some respect for your background and your name. And I think hopefully it makes you feel appreciated. That's what I'm hoping for.
It did.
All right. If you're not able to spell Leslie's last name and you're not able to find her, go ahead and go to the website for this podcast, this episode. I believe this is episode 55, so it will be mentoringdevelopers.com/episode55. And there we will have a transcript for this episode. We will have links that will ask Leslie to give us whatever she wants to share and anything that was mentioned here. And we will have Leslie's contact information, so go check it out. All right, Leslie, it was great having you. Bye, everybody.
I hope you enjoyed the show. You can read the highlights and show notes with links on mentoringdevelopers.com/episode and the number of the episode. For example, mentoringdevelopers.com/episode10 or /episode25 and so on. Let me know what you think about this episode. If you'd like to ask a question or if you have a comment, you can email me at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. Oh, and one more thing. I really want you to be part of the show, even if you are a little shy. So go ahead and type mentoringdevelopers.com/join in your web browser. This will open a Google form where you can tell me what topics interest you and what dates and times you're available for about an hour or so. Everyone is welcome, and I would be thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you at mentoringdevelopers.com/join.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.